Today is Father's Day, when we celebrate and honor dads with barbecues and cards and notes and telephone calls and family get-togethers. And it's a big deal, a really big deal. Not as big as Mother's Day, but it's still pretty much a big deal. And it fits in overall with something that we Americans like to do, and that is that we like to have parties and excuses for celebration. Birthdays and anniversaries and retirements and weddings and graduations. And often on these special occasions, we have a list that congratulates and a list that celebrates accomplishments. And on Father's Day, often the list begins with the words, "I remember. I remember when Dad captured the skunk in the backyard at the cabin. I remember when Dad stayed up all night to help me study for a test that otherwise I would have flunked and I got an A. I remember that time when I called late at night with a flat tire and he drove 100 miles and came and changed the tire on my beat-up old car." Such lists are seldom chronological. We just sort of speak the lists as the things come to mind. And the lists often include references that an outsider would not understand because it's all somewhat in the family code. But there is one thing that is evident, even to the outsider, in listening to the list. And that is that Dad has done a lot of good stuff. And it's kind of that way with a list in the Old Testament story of King David. It may not be in precise chronological order. There may be things in it that as outsiders in a different generation, we don't comprehend as readily as those who were there or who first read it. But at the end of the list, there is one thing that you know for sure in David's list, and that is that God gives the victory. 2 Samuel chapter 8 is a list of mostly military victories. And when you read the list, you can't help but think, wow, they had a lot of war going on in those days. But you know, it's kind of always been that way. You know that just recently the United States marked an anniversary of sorts, that the war in Afghanistan is now the longest war ever fought in American history. You know that at Father's Day gatherings today, if you have multiple generations that are there, there will be those present who can remember World War II and the Korean War, those that remember the Cold War and the Vietnam War and the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War and a lot of other little wars in between those major and more memorable ones. That's because the United States of America has been more or less at war for all of the lifetime of everybody's generation on Father's Day celebrations. The best estimates are that in the last century, during the 20th century, somewhere in the vicinity of 200 million people died around the world in politically motivated government initiatives. From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima to genocide in Darfur, we live in one of the most violent and bloody chapters of human history. And David lived at a time that was a violent and a bloody time as well. And he led the army. He was the general. He's the one that put things together and made the decisions and killed many of his enemies. And the partial list of those victories begins in 2 Samuel chapter 8, that in the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and he took Metheg-Ammah from the control of the Philistines. The Philistines, of course, were the perennial enemies of Israel to the southwest. They were an aggressive nation that repeatedly raided and fought against the people of Israel, often taking territory, often taking captives, and often taking many lives. So the people of Israel lived largely in terror for multiple generations whenever they thought of the Philistines. But the times had changed, David had united a kingdom that was previously divided by civil war. He had mustered an army that was experienced and increasingly formidable. And rather than just being on the defensive, David took the initiative against Philistia. The list begins with David's decisive victory at Metheg Amma. And of course, you know where that is, right? You visited the Holy Land once and went there? Well, actually, nobody knows where it is. We have no idea at all. In fact, there are some Bible scholars that don't even know if it's a place. We don't really even know what the name means. It's just two very old Hebrew words. So it doesn't mean a thing to us. And if you are one of those people who reads the Bible through in a year, it's the kind of verse and reference that you skip over because it's meaningless. But it wasn't meaningless to them. Obscure to us, but significant at the time. It was perhaps a small, but a very important victory. But that's the way it is with all of God's victories. What happens in our lives and in our families that are victories that come from God may not seem very important to our next door neighbors or will not be remembered by a generation from now. But the point is not how famous our victories, but that even the smallest of victories comes from the hand of God. The next victory on David's list was so brutal that, quite honestly, I wish I didn't have to read it. I wish it weren't in the list. David also defeated the Moabites. He made them lie down on the ground and measured them off with a length of cord. Every two lengths of them were put to death, and the third length was allowed to live. So the Moabites became subject to David and brought tribute. They were prisoners of war. They were from a little nation of Moab that was militarily and politically insignificant compared to the other nations of the Middle East at the time. And these prisoners of war were forced to lie down on the ground, unarmed, and two out of three of them were slaughtered. Not selecting any of them on the basis that they had done this or that, but simply the count off. Number one, number two, number three. Number one, kill him. Number two, kill him. Number three, you can let that person go. So if this were done today in the era of the Geneva Conventions, we would say that David was guilty as a war criminal. This was so violent and I think so senseless that it kind of takes my breath away. It's the kind of thing that we more expect to hear in some biography of Hitler or Stalin, but not of David. And if you want an astonishing little twist to this two out of three massacre, they were Moabites. David's great grandmother, Ruth, after whom one of the books of the Bible is named, was a Moabite. So if you calculate it, David was 1/8 Moabite himself. These were his own relatives, distant though they be, that he was killing. So how am I supposed to get this? How do I understand it? Well, to be sure, the Bible does not condone everything that it records. So just because it is written in the Bible does not mean that the Bible or that God approve of it. This was part of the way wars were fought in ancient days. Brutal, often senseless. David was influenced by the times in which he lived and by the pagan practices that surrounded him. And we need to be careful. It's not easy to do, but we need to be careful that we make judgments on people in other places and other parts of history on the basis of the context in which they live rather than in our time and the context in which we live. But even after that is all said, we are repulsed by his behavior. But to understand it, I think by comparison and fairness, we need to say that there are other generations or even people in other places in the world today who would say that they are repulsed by some of our behavior. They would say that as Americans and Christians in particular, that we overeat, that we are obsessed with sex, that we pollute God's creation, that we spend excessive amounts of money on ourselves, even when we know that there are people who are dying of starvation, including children in other parts of the world, that our money could help. And we, or I'll speak for myself, I become defensive when I think that others would accuse me of such felony greed. And I want to say, but wait a minute, this is my country, this is my money, this is my life. I can do with it whatever I want. And then I hear echoes of David saying, I'm the king. This is my country. I won the battle. I can do anything with them that I want to do. None of this excuses or condones what David did. But just let's not forget that we all tend to be blind to our own sins and too often presumptuous about God's blessings. Third on David's victory list is a pair of major victories. Moreover, David fought Hadadezer, son of Rahab, the king of Zobah, when he went to restore his control along the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, and 20,000 foot soldiers. He hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 of them. He put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus, and the Arameans became subject to him and brought tribute. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. This list is now talking about David's neighbor kingdoms, empires, sort of, to the north and to the east, in an area through which went some of the major trade routes, and that was important for the economics of the time. I suppose you could say that if these neighbor nations closed down those trade routes, it would be economic strangulation for Israel. So it was important to David to keep those trade routes open. But something else is going on here when you realize that these were large countries with large armies, with tens of thousands of soldiers. And Israel, that up until now has been small and divided and defenseless, is able to raise an army to take on huge enemies and to be victorious in the process of doing it. And they were amazing in that even when other nations came in through alliances and treaties to the assistance of those that fought Israel, Israel could defeat all of them. So the kingdom of Zobah, the Arameans from Syria, all of them. This was a serious war in face-to-face, hand-to-hand combat, and David and his army were triumphant. So David led Israel to decisive military triumph. The kingdom of Israel was booming. It was becoming more than just some little cluster of people that had escaped slavery in Egypt. It was now a dominant regional empire, securing trade routes and subduing neighbor nations. And how did they do this? How did they pull this off? Well, it's there. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. So the message is clear to David and to them and to us as well, that the ultimate determination of the battles of history and life are not the size of the army or the strength of the fighter or of our own abilities, but rather it is God who gives the victory. David's victories turned out to be lucrative. As was the custom of the time, the victorious army looted the plunder of those that they were victorious over. And it went to the army, or more specifically, it went to the general or to the king. So David took the gold shields that belonged to the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. From Teba and Berathai, towns that belonged to Hadadezer, King David took a great quantity of bronze. So David now is a blessed king. He is a powerful king. He is a triumphant king. But he's also becoming a very wealthy king. Because sometimes God gives benefits to those who receive his victory that they would not have predicted or anticipated. And so now the once upon a time shepherd boy of the little village of Bethlehem is becoming one of the richest men in the world. And he had hard-fought battles to get there, but they became easier as time went along. Life is not always like that. Sometimes the battles of life get harder instead of easier, but for David, they were easier because other armies didn't want to fight against him. They saw that he was invariably triumphant, and so instead, they wanted David to be their friend rather than their enemy. When too, the king of Hamath heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, he sent his son Joram to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory in battle over Hadadezer, who had been at war with too. Joram brought with him articles of silver and gold and bronze. So now the neighbor nations are saying, David, you're our friend. David, we don't want to fight. David, we'll bring you money and whatever you want. So David and the nation of Israel were very much on a roll. Huge success. But what does success do to people? I just come up with your list of friends or relatives or the very famous. Think about what power and money and influence and fame often does to otherwise good people. What you often see is that there is a legion of bad examples, so that seemingly very good people become corrupt, very moral people become unfaithful and promiscuous, and very generous people become greedy. It's just a too often repeated story. But not David. In spite of his many faults, there is an insight here into his character that helps to explain a great deal about him and his leadership and his relationship to God. King David dedicated these articles to the Lord, as he had done with the silver and gold from all the nations he had subdued: Edom and Moab, the Ammonites and the Philistines and Amalek. He also dedicated the plunder taken from Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. So David took the money and didn't keep it for himself. He didn't accrue the huge amount of wealth that every standard of the day would have said was rightfully his. Instead, he took what must have been the equivalent of billions of dollars and dedicated it to God. He would bring it back to his capital, Jerusalem, and say, all of this is God's. I give this to God. I think initially when he did it, he really had no idea where that was going to go. It was accumulated, given to God. He didn't actually know that someday this wealth would underwrite the cost of building the temple that was in the city of Jerusalem. You know, research in America is extensive when it comes to what are the generosity and giving patterns of Americans. And wonderfully, Americans are the leaders in the world in terms of both volunteering and in terms of generosity in finances. But it is a strange graph curve of distribution. There are some reports that indicate that in terms of percentage of income, the most generous people in America are those who are single mothers of minority status who are living in poverty. And they give the highest percentage of their income away. And that some of the wealthiest people in America give less and less as their wealth grows until eventually they give nothing at all, zero. But not David. He dedicated his wealth to God. And perhaps that was his greatest victory of all. It was a spiritual victory. It was all about what was most important to him. And what was most important to him was the God to whom he dedicated all of the victories that he received from God's hands. And wonderfully, prosperity didn't ruin him. So now he's got military and political and financial victories galore, and personal victory as well. And David became famous after he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. It's kind of a curious statement because I would have thought David was famous already. How could he not have his name be a household word in all of Israel? How could it not be that the Arameans and in the kingdom of Hadadezer and among the Moabites and the Egyptians and the everybody I would have thought would have known who David was? I mean, even in a day when there wasn't the mass communication that we have available today, I would have thought he would have been one of the most famous people in that part of the world. But there was a tipping point. You know, that happens in a lot of things. There's a product that's doing well and it reaches a tipping point and suddenly it becomes a bestseller. There's a person that's sort of known to a lot of people, but then something happens. There is some historic event on one day and that well-known person becomes an international celebrity. There's a book or a movie or a financial transaction or a political occurrence. And at that day, suddenly the person is truly famous. And it looks like that's what happened with David. On the day or the day after the battle in the Valley of Salt, David became famous. So what was it that happened that day? Why was that day any difference in all these other battles? Some of these other battles, it seems to me, were bigger and there were larger armies that were defeated. I'm only guessing, but my guess is that that may have been the day when it became apparent that David could be trusted with God's blessings. And that the reason for his fame was that God, that day, could trust David with whatever he would give to him. David's victories were not fleeting. He was not a one-hit wonder. They were lasting. They were durable. He put garrisons throughout Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David. The Lord gave David victory wherever he went. That's the theme. The theme of all of these battles, the theme of David's military biography, certainly the theme of 2 Samuel chapter 8, that God gave the victory. Not that David wasn't smart, he was really smart. Not that he wasn't skilled, he was amazing. This is the one who, as a young man, could take a stone and kill a giant. Not that he wasn't spiritual, he reflected his amazing connection with God in the Psalms that he wrote that we read in the Old Testament. But none of that was the explanation for the victories that David had. It was God who gave the victory. So like us, it's not most about our skill or about our experience or education. It's not all about how musical or poetic we are or how well we splice together words from our vocabulary. It's about God. It's up to God. If there's a victory, it is truly God who gives the victories of life. So it's a long list for David that ends with justice. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. Joab, son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Sariah was the secretary. Benaniah was the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. And David's sons were royal advisors. I don't know if you're interested in politics and government theory and all of that. Maybe you took a course in high school or college. Maybe you were a political science major. If so, this may be of interest to you, that there was a huge political and government transformation that took place with David's kingdom. Because the last line of the Old Testament book of Judges that precedes this kingdom era in Israel's history ends with a telling statement. Judges 21:25 says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." Or as an older translation of the Bible says it, "Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Some would call that anarchy. Some would call it extreme libertarianism. Others would say it was the height of individualism. That was Israel. Everybody did whatever they saw as fit. Everyone did what was right in his or her own eyes. But when God established David as the king of a united nation, it was completely different. A very strong central government was established. There was a standing army. There were political offices, and those filling those offices are here listed at the end of 2 Samuel 8. There was an official clergy. There were government advisors. But what is most important is the recognition here of what is God's purpose for government. What is government most supposed to do? And it's clear, government's primary role was justice, to do what was right for the people. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. So the purpose of all of these victories, and it is a partial and long list, the purpose of all these victories was not to make David famous or great or rich. The purpose was to fulfill the plans of God and to benefit the people. So David was simply the agent of God, the instrument in God's hands. It wasn't about David. It was about God. And it was about God's heartfelt desire to bring justice to the people of Israel and beyond. And that's the way it is for us. We can get caught up in this idea that what God is supposed to do is make us victorious and prosperous and healthy and successful. And those might be the side benefits of the blessings of God, but God's primary purpose is to fulfill his plan and to use us as instruments and agents of him to give his blessing and his justice to others. Charles Haddon Spurgeon was a 19th century English preacher and writer, and something of a hero and mentor for me. He made a lot of interesting statements, but one of my favorites is when Spurgeon said, "It takes a steady hand to hold a full cup." It takes a steady hand to hold a full cup. So is your cup full of God's blessings? And is your hand steady? Can he trust you? Can God trust you with a list of victories? Can he trust you with a full cup of his blessings? Because we thank you, God, for every victory and blessing, and pray that by your Spirit, we may have passionate hearts, zealous commitment, and steady hands to be instruments of your grace and justice in our world and our generation. In Jesus' name, amen.